Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Chris Courtney, who's Assistant Professor of Modern Chinese History at Durham University, and he'll be talking about his book, The Nature of Disaster in China, the 1931 Yangtze River Flood, which was published in 2018 by Cambridge University Press, has a new paperback out this year in 2020, and won the American Historical Association's Fairbank Prize in 2019. Not many weeks ago, few people outside China knew where the city of Wuhan was, and still fewer would have known quite how central it's been to so many pivotal events in the country's recent history. Wuhan's tumultuous 20th century saw it feature almost 90 years ago as the epicenter of a major flood, which, while being quite different from our pandemic today as a disaster, was at least as momentous for the population of this city and many other places across China and indeed the world. As a result, Chris Courtney's rich study of the flood and the millions affected provides compelling reading during our own period of cataclysmic Wuhan-originating events. Adopting an innovative multi-perspectival approach, Courtney looks at the flood and the events which surrounded it from numerous different angles – environmental, social, cultural, and institutional, to name a few. These different perspectives on a phenomenon of such a vast scale are revelatory in their own right, but this is also a book about much more than just a flood. The reach of the disaster and the time it happened meant that it brought together a vast range of crucial people and events, which together shed light on Chinese and global affairs at a fascinating and important juncture of history. Almost equidistant between the collapse of the Qing Empire, also an event which owes a lot to Wuhan, and the foundation of the People's Republic of China, events along the Yangtze in 1931 bring into focus a society undergoing radical change of a kind whose effects endure to the present day. But here in the present day, the author is here to say more, so I'll say, Chris Courtney, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Great intro.
Thank you very much to you as well. Before we talk about the book, which I have introed there, perhaps I could begin by asking you something of your background and how you became interested in this subject and all other matters pertaining to Wuhan and China.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I guess the story of the book really begins with my interest in Wuhan, which developed because I moved there in around 2004 on a whim, really. I didn't know anything about China or Chinese culture or history at the time. I moved there. I got a job as an English teacher. And then 8 days later, I was basically standing in the city. And in the city, kind of just absorbing everything I saw without necessarily too many preconceptions, which I think was actually probably quite a good way of going about it in retrospect, although it seemed a little bit chaotic at the time. So I spent a few years working as an English teacher off and on in Wuhan and traveling around quite a lot of China. And then I returned to the University of Manchester, where I did my my postgraduate training, actually in social anthropology, not in history. And I mean, I still kind of draw upon quite a lot of my social anthropology kind of theoretical background, although I don't necessarily wear it on my sleeve always. But the great benefit of doing a social anthropology PhD is you can spend huge amounts of time actually in the field. So I spent about a year at Wuhan University studying Chinese to start with, and then during the actual PhD, 15 months doing kind of deep immersive field work, during which time I got married and my wife had a baby, that sort of stuff.
Wow.
And thankfully I had at the University of Manchester a very supportive advisor, Sharon McDonald, who was kind of content to allow me to sort of vaguely wander nomadically through various academic disciplines and eventually kind of settle on history. And I came back from Wuhan with kind of the bare bones of, I guess, what it turned into this book, wrote my PhD thesis on that, and then was lucky enough to get two postdoctoral positions. So firstly, I got a research fellowship at the Gonville and Caius College in the University of Cambridge, where I spent a wonderful couple of years. People on this channel may know Caius as the Joseph Needham's college. So I spent quite a lot of nice time talking to some of Joseph Needham's old friends over copious amounts of wine. And then I left that fellowship and went to a fellowship at the Asia Research Institute in the National University of Singapore, which initially the institute was being run by Prasenjit Dwara. So, of course, he was a great mentor and person to talk to about Chinese history. But also at the Asia Research Institute, I was in this disaster studies unit with sociologists, geographers, urban planners. I really spent 2 years just thinking about how to understand disasters from a particular perspective. Then finally moved back from Singapore and after a brief stay at University of Southampton, got my current job at the University of Durham.
Right. Oh, well, that's great to have a bit of context for understanding the span of disciplinary interests and thematic concerns which the book covers. I mean, just in terms of the practicality and some of these questions over disciplinary boundaries and the like, writing a book that's so, or writing a dissertation, as I should say, that then led to the book, that with such a historical inflection, I mean, this was something that was still broadly acceptable as a social anthropology PhD thesis, or was the anthropology thesis a bit less historically oriented? Could you just say something about that?
I guess at the thesis level, there was more of an explicit link to some of the anthropological theory in there. A lot of the stuff that kind of eventually in the book became historiographical was anthropological in the thesis. So a lot of my interest, for example, in sensory history or like the history of the emotions was initially kind of inspired by reading things about the affective turn in anthropology and these types of things. But, you know, they were very flexible and very nice to me. As I said, I had a experienced and a very understanding supervisor who kind of let me get away with this. And eventually the thesis was also examined by historians.
Right, right. Well, that does explain something of why it is able to cross such a wide range and really sort of omnivorously browse its way over, I think, many different fascinating fields that listeners and hopefully readers too will be able to get their teeth into. But we'll jump then into the book, having sure. kind of got a sense of where it came from. Talk about, you know, turning up in Wuhan there, just kind of without too many preconceptions or indeed pre-existing knowledge of China and least of all, I guess, I think it is fair to say, not particularly famous outside China city. And this book actually is one of its kind of strengths is the great presentation it gives of Wuhan as a place at this period in time. So could you just give us kind of more of a sense of what the city of Wuhan is like and kind of how it came to be as a city and so on?
Yeah, sure. I mean, as you mentioned in your introduction, before January this year, it wasn't a city that was particularly well known outside of China. And now, unfortunately, it is for the most tragic reasons. So I'm going to have to kind of change my spiel when I introduce myself to people, I guess, in the future. it's kind of some urban forms have been there for thousands of years. It's a city that's built on this kind of confluence of the Han and the Yangtze River. So it's a really kind of fortuitous position within the kind of river system. It's known kind of as the gateway to nine provinces because you can get to all of the different provinces just by following rivers from the particular city. Actually, I say the city for most of its history, Wuhan has been three cities, two or three, Hanyang, Hankou, and Wuchang. So they developed and were, as anybody who's interested in the city can read in William Rowe's, I think, still peerless urban history of Hankou in the late imperial period. They were some of the largest and most internally cosmopolitan cities in the world. I say internal cosmopolitan because, I mean, we don't have evidence of huge amounts of people from outside the Ming and Qing empires going there, but in terms of kind of regional cosmopolitanism, they had huge, huge kind of variation. And then in the 19th century, this becomes supplemented by kind of international cosmopolitanism when Hankou, this section of the city, gets opened up as a treaty port. And eventually by the 1890s, it has a French, British, German, Russian, and Japanese concession. And so by the early 20th century, many of the things that people associate with the kind of interesting aspects of international Shanghai life existed also in Wuhan, in particularly in Hankou, albeit on a much smaller scale, down to the fact that many of the people who are supposedly British or count on in kind of documents as British were actually Indian. There's a large Indian population. There's populations from Southeast Asia. So it's an incredibly interesting and bustling city, one of the largest and most economically important cities in China, a political center, but also because it's on these rivers that I mentioned before, it's also massively prone to flooding, and throughout its history it has suffered from these kind of perennial problem with floods.
Right up to the present, in fact, right? Because I mean, that even quite recent years have seen news stories about pretty, you know, catastrophic levels. I mean, nothing on the scale of what this book describes, but very, very high water levels right in the heart of the city itself. But as someone who spent so much time there in kind of relatively recent times, and indeed, yeah, has such an attachment to the place, I mean, is it possible today still to feel the sense that, as you mentioned, this was three different cities that have grown together? I mean, are there quite different aspects and atmospheres to different parts of the city? You know, such a huge place. What was it like today?
Well, I mean, it's the sense of the distinction between the cities. I know you mentioned you used to live in Wuhan probably a decade ago. Probably even if you went back now, you'd see it much less. And the critical difference, really, there were two major differences. They've built a subway, so you can now sit. I mean, you used to have to, they built the kind of first big bridges in the 1950s. You used to have to at least see the river. Now you can just zip underneath the river. You don't even tell that you've come into contact with this vast body of water. And also just the amount of the city now that's being replaced by kind of identikit high-rise buildings, which has been going on for a long time, but over the last 5 years or so, it's really ramped up. So now I think a lot of the interesting distinctions that used to be between the cities when I first moved there are sadly being lost.
Oh, well, I guess then, you know, books which reflect something of the history of the diversity and the distinctions will be all the more valuable as a result. But what was it then that made the 1931 flood something that you were interested in focusing on? And what is it that makes it such a kind of compelling subject of study? Could you give us some sort of sense of what this flood was in terms of scale? Hard though it is, of course, for many people who've not been in one to understand, but how many people were affected and what kind of area did it cover and the like?
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, firstly, it's important to point out that the flood's not just affecting Wuhan. The flood is nationwide, in a very divided nation at the time, as it was. So it stretched all the way from Heilongjiang in the north. There was some flooding down to Guangdong in the south, from Jiangsu to Sichuan, kind of major floods in most of the major river systems in China at that period. The two kind of ones that are remembered, the Yangtze River and the Huai River now. It's called the Jianghuai Shuizai in Chinese today. But it wasn't just limited to those two rivers. It was a massive event. It flooded an area roughly the size of England and Scotland. And this is in one of the most densely populated regions in the world. So it affects huge amounts of people. But it's not really its geographic scale that makes it so exceptional. It's the fact that, because I mean, like there, as you mentioned before, there have been other floods. So the 1954 Yangtze River flood and the 1998 Yangtze River flood, in terms of the actual areas flooded, arguably may have flooded more, particularly within the Yangtze Basin. It's the humanitarian impact that really makes this so exceptional. So all estimates are very crude, but people say maybe 50 to 60 million people were affected by this flood, of whom I think it's credible to say upwards of 2 million people died. Now, I say it's credible to say upwards of, and deliberately couch that in imprecise language, because we don't actually have any clear idea about how many people died between 1931 and 1932. We only know it was a staggering number of people. In fact, most disasters in history, we don't really have an accurate figure for how many people died. And this is no exception. But quantifying the number of people who died has never been particularly interesting for me. I'm not really interested in kind of depicting this as the kind of superlative flood in history. And I think the kind of numbers games that some historians can get into about disasters can often be a distraction and not particularly very interesting. So what I'm really critically trying to do with this book is instead to think about why so many people died, not necessarily pin a number on the number of people who died.
And I mean, is it because of the, I guess, inherent imprecision of numbers, or because of the prevalence of other better known floods and so on, that it hasn't got as much attention? I mean, this particular event, what is it that sort of left it relatively unexplored by scholars in the past?
Well, I guess the kind of closest comparable event would be the 1938 Yellow River floods, right, where the Kuomintang deliberately breached the dikes and flooded huge amounts of territory, as has been explored by a few authors, most recently in his excellent book. Michael Muscolino talked a lot about that particular flood. Kate Eshton-Tarpley's also done some research into that. Critically there, though, it's a fairly simple story. You can say they opened the dikes, it caused the flood. So there's kind of a simple narrative. Whereas what's happening in the 1931 flood, determining why so many people died, isn't a simple question of thinking of that moment when the disaster began. You have to think about it kind of in a slightly more complex way. So it's not so clear cut in terms of causality. And also generally, I'm not saying this flood was exceptional there. I mean, there's huge drought famines in China in the end of the 1920s. Which killed millions more than this, and barely anything's been written about them as well.
Well, and I guess, I mean, as you say, the kind of difficulty in teasing out cause and effect and the details of what exactly did transpire. I mean, this is the task that you approach, I would say, with such aplomb in the book itself. And you kind of spend a lot of it, I guess, really deftly balancing a focus on the social dimensions, the kind of extent to which, disasters are anthropogenic or have effect that is magnified by the very presence or the behavior of human beings, and also then the natural or environmental forces which, many look to in talking about these, many humans look to in talking about these disastrous events. You basically frame this interplay, I guess, between these and other forces as what you call a disaster regime. So could you kind of explain how that helps you to understand the inherent complexities in this quite difficult to approach event?
Sure. So what I'm really trying to do, I mean, you can boil it down in this book, is to apply some of the insights that I've got from disaster studies to history. And apply some historical insights that I've got to disaster studies. And these two things kind of coalesce within this idea of the disaster regime that I try to develop during this book. So probably one of the simplest yet most important contributions that disaster studies has made is to essentially get rid of the idea that there can be such a thing as a natural disaster. And I'm totally on board with that. I don't think the language of natural disaster should ever be used. However, there's a risk when you push it too far in this way, and some people do it for effect, that you essentially remove any of the agency of nature. So essentially what you're doing, And what you risk doing when you're writing a disaster history is saying, look at this terrible thing that you all thought was caused by nature. Well, actually, it was caused by human beings, which I think is just a very reductive position. It's basically a social determinist position that is no less reductive than the environmentally determinist position of saying something is a natural disaster. So I tried to develop this disaster regime, and it's kind of inspired both by the idea of a political regime or the flood regime, which is something that ecologists talk about, as kind of a kind of more holistic model for thinking about all of the different elements that are continuously in interaction between the anthropogenic and environmental causality that help to conspire to cause the events that human beings experience as disasters. So it's a kind of an ingredients list for all the factors that you need to take into consideration when you're thinking about disasters.
Mm.
And so just to add one more thing, the other kind of element in the disaster regime is, if when you think about it, kind of an analog for a political regime. Political regimes change continuously and are contingent on their historical era. So the other point I'm trying to make with the disaster regime is so do disasters. They're not something that occur outside of history. They are all very much rooted in their particular historical epoch. So the same things that were making the 1931 flood so disastrous were also occurring in other regions in China and various parts of the world during that particular period.
Right, right. And yeah, and it's a kind of strength of the book too, that it evokes such a particular historical and social setting, which, yeah, doesn't sort of drag us towards the grander abstractions of disasters as either man-made or purely natural, whatever that might mean. And even through six chapters that very kind of nicely balance these different concerns, you're kind of constantly bringing both into play. So in chapter one, you kind of adopt what you call an environmental historical approach, and cover something of the sort of history of settlement of the region and some of the, I guess, deeper temporal span of what people have been doing in this part of China and the world over the centuries. So what is the sort of history of human interaction with the Yangtze in particular, but also with kind of broader bodies of water around Hubei province and this area?
Right. So, it's changed continuously over time as the disaster regime has changed. But as you said in this first chapter, I'm kind of trying to trace it back all the way to kind of the beginning, really, of the human settlement of this region, when the Middle and Lower Yangtze Valley looked very different from the way it did today. The zoologist Samuel Turvey has described this as the Amazon of the East. It's a hugely biodiverse area covered with lakes, rivers, and wetlands. This kind of wetland system expanding all the way from the coast up to Hubei province. And this biodiversity is a product of flooding, right? It's a product of this annual flood pulse, which makes this an incredibly ecologically diverse area. And this is one of the reasons that people settle it. So because there's this huge biodiversity, it's relatively abundant in the kinds of things that you would want to find if you were a hunter-gatherer. And so right from the very beginning, people have settled this region, not in spite of flooding, but because of it. And then they eventually develop this system of wet rice agriculture, which comes to sort of dominate the economy. And this too is a product of flooding, right? So what you're doing by making a kind of wet rice system is you're imitating the natural effects of a wetland. Only you're doing it in a more regulated fashion in order to be able to reap the benefits of this kind of semi-anthropogenic flood pulse.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, what developed in the region is the subject of more kind of familiar history, the kind of hydraulic history of China, which has been studied by many people, for example, Pierre Tianwil, Peter Perdue, more recently people like Zhang Jiayan and Yan Gao have looked at this kind of long-term development of the kind of dike networks and sluice gates and all these sorts of hydraulic structures. So my contribution to the way they're talking about that is really to think about how these structures enter the kind of the system of flooding and turn something like a hydrological system turn flooding, which is a kind of natural feature of the hydrological system, into something that can become this kind of big aberrant flood. So the kind of flood you have when a dike collapses is very different to the type of flood you would have in a landscape without dikes. So from this point, there is always a kind of an anthropogenic element within the kind of disaster regime. And also, of course, dikes depend on politics, economics. So these factors also become kind of important in how we understand this.
And is this why, I mean, is the kind of political regulation and I suppose, yeah, the presence of water management, I mean, there is obviously some influential work to perhaps stuff that may no longer hold much water, if you'll forgive the pun these days, but ideas about the importance of water management to China's entire political system, perhaps looking to Viktor Orgel and others. But in terms of the foundation of the dry city, if you like, or of Wuchang, Hankou, and Hanyang at different times, was this something that was primarily predicated on regulation and management of this sort of paddy region?
You mean in terms of the city itself, or in terms of the region more generally?
Yeah, the actual city. I mean, are the origins of the city kind of as an urban cluster primarily something that came about because of a need to regulate dikes and manage an increasingly complex sort of agricultural society?
Well, I don't want to sound evasive, but I mean, it depends which dikes you're talking about, because there are different management structures that depend on different dikes, right? So there's ones that are managed by local populations, and then there's the larger dikes that are managed kind of more centrally. I would say that the city, certainly, as I mentioned before, owes its much of its kind of growth to the fact that this is a kind of water abundant landscape in terms of transportation, the other kind of major kind of use that people have of water. But another important thing about thinking about Wuhan and the region more generally is that you mentioned just their dry city. Of course, Wuhan was a dry city, but it also had huge amounts that weren't. So much of the city actually existed floating in the harbors. And it was a very seasonal city as well. The rivers would rise and fall with the annual flood pulse. So huge numbers of the people who lived in the city lived there seasonally, and some of them would live on boats, some of them would live in all these kind of sampans that existed. And the same is true in the countryside. So we tend to think about the residents of this province as rice farmers, but they were also fisher folk. They were also people who gathered and cultivated wetland crops. And all this kind of system that I describe, which is to a certain extent exists in greater cooperation with the kind of wetland environment, is what I describe as wetland cultures that have existed since ancient times and of course declined as the wetlands retreated under human activity, but still existed at the time of the 1931 flood, albeit in small amounts in comparison to the past.
Right. And I guess, I mean, a lot of that changed with the arrival of the colonial powers that you mentioned, and some of the urban transformation that occurred as a result of the assignment of the treaty port status to Wuhan, and we'll perhaps touch on that a bit later on. But you just painted quite an evocative picture there of a sort of ecology, if you like, of a kind of, I mean, symbiosis feels like a lazy and inadequate word, and probably just inappropriate. But in any case, humans living amid, at the very least, large amounts of water, and often on and reliant on for many reasons. And chapter two indeed deals with the ecology of the region, and you've brought up this kind of flood pulse idea a few times. So how to understand this place and the relationships that are here between humans and water and other beings in the ecology, as opposed to the environment? I mean, what's the distinction here between, as you put it yourself, environmental and ecological history of a place like this?
Well, of course, ecological history is really just a subset of environmental history, and I distinguish the two really largely just so I can have like two different themes and two different chapters. I guess you could say the first chapter is more kind of traditional environmental history, and the ecological chapter is dealing with kind of more recent trends. I mentioned Michael Muscolino's book. He wrote this Ecology of War book, and there's been ecological history has been kind of on the ascendant within environmental history recently. But the way I'm, The way I'm using it in this particular book is to distinguish between the kind of long-term effects of the kind of interaction between humans and the wetland environment. And in this chapter, I'm talking specifically about the 1931 flood pulse. So specifically about what happened when the valley was inundated during the course of 1 year. And kind of central to my argument is this kind of attempt to complicate some of the previous histories that have been written about Chinese famines and disasters, which I argue have too much attention on kind of the nutritional effects of disasters. Of course, nutrition is vitally important to the way that we understand any kind of event such as this, but actually it's only one of the drivers of mortality. Historians largely write about it because that's what concerned people at the time. And people, the records are full of kind of the destruction of systems of nutrition, but that doesn't necessarily represent the true dynamics of what's going on during a disaster. And if you take a kind of ecological rather than a strictly economic approach to a flood, what's happening during a flood isn't just the destruction of huge amounts of plants and domestic animals and these types of things. That's very important. But what's also happening is this huge generative effect of the flood pulse. So actually what was affecting people in 1931, and one of the major drivers of mortality, wasn't the destruction that was caused by the flood. It was the very fact that the flood pulse was so ecologically productive. It was creating things, for example, like huge populations of mosquitoes, huge populations of flies, huge populations of schistosomiasis carrying freshwater snails, and all of these types of things. And these were the types of things, if you actually look at the mortality statistics, that were really driving mortality. Of course, the lack of nutrition ensured that people were more susceptible to these types of infection, and also pushed them into greater congregations so that they could become susceptible to being infected by these diseases. But thinking about this as just a famine caused by a flood is a very limited way of understanding it. And also thinking kind of the logical corollary of that is that if you can't just think about this as a famine caused by a lack of food, you also can't think about the kind of response of the state of providing food as necessarily doing a great job in assuaging the disaster, which is a point I make later on in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, absolutely. We'll get on to that as we look at sort of some of the, ham-fisted and certainly inadequate responses from officialdom to what went on in 1931 and indeed beyond. You speak then of a population living on water and with water, and indeed sharing this space with, as you point out, from this sort of ecological perspective, a great variety of other beings, of non-human actors in the landscape and indeed in the actual water, and the long-term experiences of the population with cholera and snail fever and other kind of waterborne maladies is obviously a particularly unpleasant part of that kind of waterborne experience. Moving on to kind of what kind of a culture develops in a very watery environment like this. In chapter three, you kind of adopt a sort of more cultural historical approach by focusing in, and I think really often quite entertainingly, it must be said, on one particular local deity, the Dragon King, the Long Wang. So who was the Dragon King? What was his presence in Wuhan? And what does this tell us about sort of people's interaction with this watery world that surrounded them?
Sure, yeah. So the story of Long Wang Miao, or the kind of Dragon King Temple, is probably one of the ones that kind of drew me first into studying the 1931 flood. So there's this story that emerges that in 1930, this new kind of Kuomintang-affiliated regime that takes over Wuhan wants to destroy a local temple because they want to build a road. And at the time, the temple is dedicated to this figure, the Dragon King. And dragons are intimately associated within local popular religion with water. Right? So dragons live in rivers and lakes and various bodies of water, and they can, they're kind of halfway between a kind of natural animal and some sort of deity. And there's got a long history of writing about dragons, as not from ancient times to the present day, but they can also in some variations shift between being human beings and being dragons, or snakes and dragons and all these types of things. So semi-mythic, semi-kind of animalistic figure, but critically associated with water. And they fly up into the skies and shoot rain clouds out of their mouths and can cause all sorts of storms. And of course, to the Kuomintang, to some members of the Kuomintang regime, this is all just a load of superstitious rubbish, right? During the era of kind of great persecution of what people described as this new category of superstition. And so they want to get rid of these beliefs. They also want to build a road. They don't think twice about knocking down this temple. But what occurs one year later, they have one of the worst floods in the city's history. So fairly understandably, many members of the local population draw a causal link between the destruction of a temple designed to regulate flooding and a massive flood that happens the next year. And so before long, you've got all these people coming down to the riverside and they're kind of praying to the Dragon King, asking him for protection. And their story begins to circulate around the world. There's a guy, Xie Tian Mao, who is kind of critical to my book. He wrote the big diary that is kind of the basis of a lot of the stuff in Wuhan. But also foreign journalists writing about this, and in Singapore and London, everybody's reading about these beliefs of these people, and it becomes a way to ridicule the people of Wuhan, really. But then when you get down into what's really happening on the streets, you can see that there is what's happening have distinct political factions. So you have all these kind of secularist journalists who are kind of decrying the Dragon King cult as this kind of impediment to the way that the modern state should be responding to a disaster. But then you also have all of these kind of figures, people like Xia Douyin, the leader of the local garrison, who are kind of egging on and in some cases leading these processions. But they're also trying to politically manipulate the situation. They've also got something to gain from portraying this and as a kind of an act of vengeance by a deity. So, I mean, really, the more you read into it, the more complex and political it becomes. And I guess the take home from this chapter that I would have for people is yes, there's a great deal to be learned by thinking about the way that hegemonic modernity, as Prasenjit Dwar has described it, kind of imposed its own beliefs upon religious structures in China. And there's been some great scholarship about that in the Republican era. But at the same time, we have to not be too credulous and actually think that the people doing these things actually necessarily believed in what they were doing. And to a certain extent, the secularist critique that this is all kind of a great way of deluding the people, in some instances, I would argue, is actually fairly accurate.
Right. And I mean, it's some ways secularist critique all the way down. If much of the source material that, you know, people would have learnt about this from in the form of newspaper reports going all over the world, and indeed, I guess, a lot of officially sanctioned documentation that came out under the Kuomintang's supervision would also be couched in this sort of suspicious term as regarded superstition, as you put it, and things that seem to be holdovers from kind of pre-modern age. But as you do, it's only by delving down to ground level, and indeed you go as far at times I felt almost to embody the, well, no, that's not fair, but to take the position of the Dragon King and actually to speak of the Dragon King as a being, an agentive force within the city, which I think gave that sort of sense of localism and a rich, I guess, yeah, cultural layering, a lot of depth. Even more local, perhaps, and even more kind of in the world of Wuhan experiencing the flood is your sensory history in chapter four. You've mentioned already that this was perhaps something that came from your anthropological training, and it comes through, I think, really well. So what was it that kind of opened the door for you to this sort of sensory approach to the history of the flood, and what were the sights, sounds, and smells of the flood as it was experienced by residents of the city?
I mean, it's a couple of things, really. Partly, I kind of tried to adopt a position when I was writing this. It's funny that you said that in that comment that you felt that I was almost embodying the dragon. I spent a long time trying to do that. I realized at one stage the only way I can write this is to, at the very least, suspend my disbelief or inhabit a world in which a dragon can actually exist and depart from that as a subject position. In the same way, I mean, you might think about this as kind of, I try to kind of adopt this kind of method history writing approach. A lot of this sensory stuff came from actually being in Wuhan. And I was in Wuhan the same month one time that I was writing about. It was in August. And as you all know, in August in Wuhan, it is horrendously hot. It's I'll talk about a little bit more about that later on when I talk about my next project. So it made me think, well, if I'm horrendously hot, what must it have been like for all those refugees who are just living without any of the kind of mod cons that I've got to alleviate heat? So that was kind of one spur to thinking about this. The other one was the fact that witness accounts of the flood, particularly in Wuhan, are so rich in terms of the details that they provide about the sensory and emotional experience. Yet when you get to reading about the flood in government documents or other documents, kind of official documents, all of these, as I say in the book, all of the adjectives have been purged. All of this kind of rich description has been missing. So I wanted to, in a sense, to kind of recapture those. But I also think there's something critical to be gained for thinking about this in terms of this kind of holistic disaster regime. Because unless you can begin to understand how people are experiencing something, and of course we can never totally understand, we can only get an impressionistic idea. But unless we can have a degree of empathy, we can't hope to understand why people behave the way they do during a disaster. And behavior is a critical aspect of the disaster regime. So I trawled through all these accounts, both the kind of this part of this being a big city full of both Chinese and foreign journalists, is there's loads of accounts looking at all of the kind of commonalities. And for example, we can see many of the accounts focus on these kind of grisly images that people are kind of confronted with, the dead bodies floating. Others are descriptions of how bizarre it is, familiar landmarks just covered in water. The landscape has been subverted. Yet more are kind of discussions about how you can't see anything. So the electricity is gone in the city. So half the time it's completely pitch black and you're living in this terrifying environment in the dark. Or you can't physically see because the water is obscuring you. And then the auditory environment becomes incredibly important. You have all these accounts of people talking about, oh, I could just hear people moaning from here or dogs howling. But undoubtedly, the most often described sensory experience that you have during the flood is the horrendous smell. So people are talking about it stank. And this is a kind of, doesn't matter who, so there are some refugee accounts, there are kind of foreign accounts, there are Chinese journalistic accounts, they all focus on this stench, which to a certain extent you might think would, you can suggest this is some sort of leveling, right? So everybody, no matter who you are, you can't escape the stink of death and shit, basically, wherever you are. But actually, there's a critical difference, as I mentioned in the book, between smelling this and having to actually get into the flood water and tackle the problems of dealing with this. And actually, the more you look into it, the more there are critical distinctions of class and the different kind of cultures living in the city in terms of like coding the different sensory experiences that they have.
Right, and that, I guess, provides a really interesting angle on the sense that, I guess, as we're getting today, in fact, that there are winners and losers, and it's not that, you know, the myth of the great leveling influence is actually, well, it's exactly that, a myth in many, many cases. So there were sort of winners and losers from these events, or at least people who were able to kind of maintain a semblance of, well, quote unquote, normal life, to use a much used phrase. What were some of these distinctions that I guess are so curiously approached by the medium of smell and other senses?
Well, I mean, so one of the kind of the most obvious examples of this is the foreign population. I don't want to harp on the foreign population like it was all the foreign population living in splendor whilst everybody else lived in squalor, because there were plenty of members of the Chinese elite who were similarly privileged to the foreigners who were in the city. It's just, it's particularly obvious because you can tell from the accounts, because they're distinguished also by their ethnicity. So the one of the kind of most obvious sites is at the foreign race club in Wuhan, where you have all of these foreigners end up going out to the race club, even though of course you can't race your horses because the pitch is all flooded. And there's these descriptions of them just drinking whiskey, complaining that they haven't got any ice for their whiskey because the ice factory has closed down. Mm. Where, like, meters away in the stable where they ordinarily would have the horses, but the foreign population have already evacuated their very expensive horses to Shanghai. You have large numbers of refugees living with barely any food and water in the stables that, as I mentioned in the book, is kind of separated from the clubhouse by very little physical distance, but there's a vast chasm between the experience of the disaster in these two spaces.
Mm, mm. And I mean, the kind of last two chapters, I think, start to approach, because it's there earlier too, but I mean, definitely delve into a lot more depth as regards the experiences of the refugees and those who were, in many cases like this, difficult to approach given the prevalence of records penned by people who were better off and more privileged, but who were kind of the overwhelming majority of people affected by these events. So what kind of measures were taken by these by the nationalist government and other kind of local, philanthropic agencies, and how were those responded to by people who'd been thrown into destitution by these flood events?
So yeah, the last two chapters I kind of try to develop these two types of expertise and contrast what I describe as this kind of technical expertise against the kind of vernacular expertise of ordinary people. So in the first of these two chapters, I'm describing the development of this National Flood Relief Commission, which is staffed by an international group of people involving Kuomintang, politicians, League of Nations figures from the kind of John Hope Simpson, who's kind of an ex-British imperial guy, is one of the major people who are in charge. It's very international, very eclectic in some respects, but also very narrow in its view of how you tackle some of these crises. And so what develops is this kind of insular institutional idea dominated by some familiar ideas. People who've read books by Janet Chun or Lillian Lee, or these people who've spoken about the way that ideas of pauperization come to be so prevalent in the idea in the response to famine. Well, it's dominated by that, the idea that we have to prevent at all costs impoverished people from becoming too comfortable with the charity that we're giving them. It's a familiar idea from the Victorian workhouse to the colonial administration of India. It's found throughout the world during this period. So they have this kind of technical expertise that they're dealing with. In practical terms, they don't often get to apply it because they have to actually deal with this with the hand they're dealt. And they come to rely on this massive loan of wheat from America, which is depicted at the time as this grand charitable gesture from the Americans, but it's actually just a means of dumping this huge amount of agricultural surplus that the Americans don't want on a foreign market and dictating the terms of loan repayment. So anyway, this is the kind of official response. Everybody, I would say, there's nobody who is kind of like deliberately trying to kill people. These people genuinely are doing their best to try and improve people's lives, but they're often hampered by a kind of institutional thinking that doesn't allow them to necessarily accommodate other ways of thinking about dealing with disasters, particularly some of the more effective existing indigenous forms of relief that are already there. So that's the first of these two chapters. In the second chapter, I look again. We go to Wuhan, and I'm looking at the kind of refugee response. And in many ways, what refugees are doing are precisely the types of things that all the kind of official relief bodies don't want them to do. They're doing things like begging. They are kind of, some people are engaging in prostitution, all sorts of things. Many of them are kind of renting out water taxis, but they're actually quite effective responses to the disaster based on these kind of customary techniques that they have to survive. People in this region know how to survive a disaster, unfortunately, because they've experienced so many of them before. But gradually, the local state in particular, the police force and the aforementioned Shadoyin and the local military begin to clamp down on all of these things because they see them as social problems. And secondly, because they are terribly afraid of the communists, who they think will use the flood as a pretext to come back into Wuhan, where they had been based just a few years previously, prior to 1927. So this kind of the local military and the police force enact martial law and begin to force refugees into camps. Refugees, contrary to the way they're popularly portrayed in kind of official relief literature, many of them actually don't want to go into relief camps and receive free food because they don't really want to surrender their autonomy and they don't really trust the state. But they're kind of eventually forced at gunpoint into these refugee camps, where many of them end up, because these refugee camps are built too quickly and they're not ready to accommodate them, the level of communicable diseases that are in these camps is incredibly high. So I guess the final ingredient of the disaster regime that I discuss within that chapter is the way that kind of an oppressive political regime and the context of warfare acts to exacerbate the consequences of a humanitarian catastrophe.
Right. And I think that sort of brings out nicely a point I wanted to draw attention to right at the start, which is just what an incredible concatenation of different absolutely pivotal developments in China's 20th century history this flood represents and kind of brings into focus. And I think the negotiations of ordinary residents of Wuhan with what you referenced earlier is this hegemonic modernity is another kind of absolutely fascinating and engaging part of the book as a whole.
And I ought to mention just in passing that the Japanese also invade Manchuria halfway through the flood as well. So it's something that's mentioned in the book that I haven't had time or haven't managed to bring up yet, but some people might be interested.
Yeah, well, I think the kind of onrushing kind of tide of events, if you will, and this really cataclysmic occurrence in China's contemporary, I guess, identity and national narrative may also have contributed to the obscuring of the events that occurred immediately before that, because suddenly events in Manchuria, rather take center stage. In the epilogue, as I was just going to mention, of the book, you kind of bring things a little closer to the present in some ways, or offer some reflections on more recent developments, including things like the building of the Three Gorges Dam, which is a little way up the river, up the Yangtze from Wuhan. Elaborate a little more on this disaster regime idea, or bring things into kind of summation there. I just wanted to ask, I guess, in reference to that, what you might say about the disaster regime as a kind of lens through which to look at what's going on today, if that's not too unfair a question, in a sort of pandemic era.
I haven't given this a huge amount of thought, although I have, of course, like everybody else, been thinking a lot about the pandemic. I guess two things spring to mind, particularly about where we draw the line about what counts as causality, right? So in terms of, we don't as yet know what exactly happened in terms of the transmission of this particular disease. If it was, as many theories suggest, started in the Huanan seafood market, then do we focus in on the particular moment of transmission, which may have happened in that market, may have happened any time along the supply chain, of these exotic animals, which included things like bats and pangolins, which apparently weren't on sale at this particular market. So where do we think about the kind of the cause? Why are we so focused on one moment of zoonotic transmission as the cause of a pandemic? Also, I mean, one of the ideas that I mentioned in the book that I've taken from disaster studies more generally is the fact that causality doesn't stop at the moment a disaster happens, right? So we have all these various things like cascading disasters, compounding disasters. So not only do we have to take the causality back before the point of zoonotic transmission, which is in no way to exonerate people involved in the hugely destructive wildlife trade, which I think definitely needs to be banned in response to this pandemic. But also we need to take causality forward. We need to think about causality not as something that stops at the moment of zoonotic transmission, but something that's built into the system. And of course, the underlying structures that allow pandemics to spread throughout the world are also structures that we depend upon for the particular economy that we have at the moment and the particular institutional political responses we have in each of the different countries needs to be examined as also individual causal factors alongside this original moment of zoonotic transmission.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think we do well in that case to adopt this sort of multi-perspectival and almost a multidisciplinary approach to the cultural, political, social, institutional, and so on dimensions of what we're experiencing at the moment. It might help us cut through the vast volume of paranoia and nonsense. And I mean, not that paranoia is necessarily wrong. It's obviously all very bad. But in any case, I hope might provide a more constructive way of thinking about what is a very difficult and confusing set of events. But Chris, thank you so much for giving us your time today. Before we let you go, I'll just ask you our final New Books Network question, which is what is it you've got in the pipeline at the moment? You've already hinted at something, but could you give us a bit more of a sense of what it is?
So yeah, I'm kind of at the moment trying to write a second monograph also about Wuhan. I mean, I was slightly concerned that having two books about Wuhan would make me seem limited, but I'm figuring now that Wuhan is a more important topic. So maybe more explicitly. So my second book is tentatively entitled A Century in the Furnace, Living with Heat in Urban China, 1920 to 2020. So I'm looking at Wuhan being one of the three oven cities of China. I'm looking at how ordinary people have coped with living with extreme temperatures between this particular period. And the kind of the ambition of this is to really think about the development of what's known as the urban heat island effect, how actually people have experienced cities actually physically getting hotter as the effect of things like too much use of concrete, the destruction of green spaces, and also the overuse of air conditioning have actually heated up cities. But I'm also using heat as a kind of prism for looking at broader social political changes in China in the 20th century. This project, as many of my projects do, started with me talking to old people in Wuhan and then telling me about how in the kind of 1960s and 70s, everybody used to sleep outside on the street together. We were all hot, but we were all hot together. I don't think there's a kind of better metaphor for the collective era. We were all poor, but we were all collectively poor. And the kind of the forms of nostalgia and remembrance that people have of that particular era and the inexorable rise of air conditioning, the privatization of space, all of these kind of features.
Well, that sounds absolutely, yeah, fascinating. And together with the book we've studied today, definitely, I think, a solid base for an entire strand, perhaps, of, Western Wuhanology or Wuhanxue or some kind of separate discipline, perhaps.
Well, there is an Institute of Wuhan Studies at the Jianghan University, so.
Well, there you go. Then you could be the branch founder of the, Northern England or maybe Britain branch of this area of this field, this burgeoning field. But yes, Chris, thank you so much again for appearing on the show today. It was really great to have you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Really enjoyed talking.
And listeners, thank you too for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.